I am Roy Malloy, and you are listening to The Dawn of Crime, a podcast dedicated to creating a space where the people who came and went in our past shaped us into the country we became through their shiftery crookery. I'm going to say crookery and shifty all in the same sentence. I am joined by Professor and Dr. Claire Wright today, who is one of my standout favourites when it comes to reading Australian histories, and has contributed some of the most interesting pieces about social history that I've come across. I first came across her not realising that I would one day also be acquainted with her when I read a staggering array of stuff on the internet and in hard copy about the Eureka Stockade. And then also when I took an interest in Sly Grog, I started reading Beyond the Ladies' Lounge, which is one of the most interesting books about Australia that you never knew existed until now. And I highly recommend you get out and read Beyond the Ladies' Lounge if you would like to see just how involved and invested women were in so many levels of both illicit and legally supplied alcohol in Australian history. If that's not enough of an introduction, I can also say she's a bang-up bloke of a woman, is Dr. Claire Wright. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Roy. I've never been described as that before. Been described as many things, but not a bang-up bloke of a woman.
I had a friend and I introduced his wife. I introduced him as Mr. and then his wife's name. You know, the old way we'd often address envelopes was to Mrs. and then the bloke's name. And then,
yeah, no, my husband does that too, but he does it somewhat disparagingly towards himself as a kind of swipe, I don't know, because it's seen that I have the higher profile of the two of us, so he calls him.
My other half of this operation.
Mr. Claire Wright.
My other half of this operation is one of the most powerful women I've ever met called Knuckles, and she's also, her people name is Zoe, but we don't really run that past her that often because she uses the knuckles. But and it's a thrill to have you on talking to us today about your understandings of criminal history, but specialising us, I think, specifically in that early colonial period. And we had Dr. Chris McConville on recently, and he was talking about that pre-1880 or pre-Federation, really, period of crime, which we were talking about it as survival crime. Would you say there's a difference between the criminals of post-Federation and Gold Rush period in the reasons people were committing crimes?
It's a super interesting question. I suppose I'd preface it by saying that my interest in crime hasn't come specifically through that lens. Like, I've never researched criminal history as the particular focus of my inquiry. I've never set out to look at what were the criminal activities, who were the criminals, what were the what did the scales of justice look like. They've come more as byproducts of my research into particular areas, and in particular my focus on looking at and looking for the women of history, and who are largely left out of the story. And then that very much gets you into the terrain of criminality, because, yeah, particularly in the 19th century, I think survival crime is a great way of putting it. It was about people having to keep their heads above water in whatever way that they could. And particularly for women, there were so few avenues for that. And there were so many restrictions and prohibitions on the activities that women could do. It almost, by virtue of being a woman, it criminalized your behavior. And then, of course, because I've made a particular focus of the Gold Rush, looking at the Eureka Stockade, and so that book, The Forgotten Rebels of Eureka, was looking at women's role in the Eureka Stockade, that period of the Gold Rush was one of not lawlessness. People often think of it as that, as a kind of Wild West. You know, we have an image of in our head of what the Wild West looked like from American television, particularly from that kind of Hollywood saloon, you know, bust into the bar and everybody pulls their gun out, and kind of idea. But Australia was never like that. It was actually much more orderly and well regulated under the restraints of British justice. But it was, the Gold Rush was a topsy-turvy era, and there were so many people people going for it, making their own way in the world, and also certain restrictions that, again, criminalised their behaviour, particularly around gold seeking and licence keeping. So, I'm not so sure whether I could, to answer your original question, say whether the 20th century, whether there was a particular difference in criminal activity in terms of it being more, I guess what you're suggesting is that 19th century criminality was a question of putting food on the table, and 20th century criminality had more to do with, you know, character or motivation to commit crime. I'm not going to make that distinction because I haven't studied it in that regard, but I would certainly go along with your characterization of colonial crime as being of a survival nature for white people, of course. It's a whole nother kettle of fish if you want to talk about criminal activities that were perpetrated on Indigenous people. Whether you can consider that to have been about settler survival. Certainly wasn't about Indigenous survival, wasn't it, when they were massacred?
And in the perspective of being female in Ballarat, let's give it a year, let's say 1845, right in the throng of it.
Is it in the throng of the gold rush or the throng of... settlements of pastoralism.
What did I say? 54.
You said 45? 54, yeah. 54 makes more sense.
There's my dyslexia playing up. You're in the throng of the gold rush and you're female. What was, were there crimes particularly that women were more typically likely to commit in and around that time and period than men?
Well, I guess the two that would obviously spring to mind would be sly grogging, because it became illegal to sell alcohol on the gold fields. It was outlawed. And yet there was a massive market for it. And so there was money to be had, there was coin to be turned, and there were people who were there who were prepared to distribute it, and they were largely women. And so sly grogging was not an exclusively female activity, but it was largely dominated by women. And we even see this in pictures such as S.T. Gill's illustrations of the time. If you see a woman standing outside a tent, and on that tent is written refreshments or coffee, you know that that's a sly grog tent. And that's S.T. Gill's way of pointing out that that woman in the photo is engaging in a criminal activity, and yet he, like most other people at the time, turned a blind eye to it. It wasn't something that had community disapproval. It just had legal disapproval, and not even that. I mean, the police turned a blind eye to it as well for a price. So the protection racket in sly grogging was one of the great money spinners for the police at the time, and also became a thorn in the side of miners and contributed to a lot of the sense of grievance and disaffection that was going on at the goldfields that ultimately led to the Eureka uprising. The sense that those who were supposed to be policing the goldfields and keeping people safe were actually part of the problem, and the maladministration that was going on with, in all sorts of regards was definitely one of the diggers' main grievances. So women were sly groggers. This partially came out of a tradition that sprung from Ireland of the shebeen, S-H-E-B-E-E-N, which was a long-standing tradition that was technically illegal, but again, authorities turned a blind eye to it. And shebeens were essentially a room in a widow's house where people could go and they could get alcohol. And this was a way for a widow to survive and to provide for her children. And it was seen as being a kind of form of communal charity. Rather than sending this woman and her kids to the poorhouse, which was the alternative, because obviously in these days there's no welfare, there's no widow's pension, there's no other way for a woman to respectfully keep herself, that the local neighbourhood would go to old Mother O'Reilly's house and could go into her kitchen, her shebeen, and get alcohol. So this tradition continued on the gold fields. The other one, of course, that will come to people's mind readily is prostitution. The way that you find that in the records is to look for evidence of a disorderly house. That was the euphemism for prostitution, was keeping a disorderly house. And women were prosecuted for that. Or so basically the brothel keepers, the madams, were prosecuted for keeping a disorderly house. And the prostitutes themselves were prosecuted for being without visible means of support. And that was the euphemism for that. And so again, there were protection rackets involved in this as well. So, you know, those are the two main ways in which you would find women in the court documents. Occasionally you'll find them fighting each other, using bad language in the street. Ellen Kelly was famously pulled up for riding furiously in the street, riding her horse in a fast and loose way. And women did fight in the streets, fought each other, fought their husbands or their partners. Women very often took their partners to court for domestic violence, which we don't necessarily expect they would have done, but it was done in very great numbers. And they did take each other to court as well. And so these are the ways that women do pop up. Sometimes, just sometimes, you find a woman, and I'm going to tell you this story about being in the archives in the Public Records Office of Victoria, looking through just boxes and boxes and boxes of official materials. And I came across a manila folder, and on the top of the manila folder, it said Elijah Smith. And I looked through Elijah Smith's folder because I was just doing the fine tooth comb thing. And I realized that this file was about a bank robbery that happened in Ballarat in 1854. It was a big robbery of, I'm pretty sure from memory, it was the Bank of Victoria, where it was held up by four people, including Elijah Smith, and completely cleaned out. And I was reading through these files and I'm thinking, hang on, there's something's not quite right here. And I realized after a while that what was not right about this is that the person they appeared to be talking about in all of these police documents and various detectives and things was a woman, that there was a woman involved in this, and that they had caught a woman in a pub who was boasting about having the proceeds of the robbery stuffed up her dress and in her garters and under her corsets and her crinolines. And then I followed this through, and anyway, lo and behold, Elijah Smith is Eliza Smith. And Eliza Smith was one of the four bank robbers of the Bank of Victoria in 1854, which was big news throughout the colony. And she was eventually caught and prosecuted along with the rest of them. But someone at some point in time in filing these documents must have said, oh, no, that can't be right. A woman couldn't have been one of the four people to hold up the Bank of Victoria. It couldn't have been Eliza. It must have been Elijah, and had misgendered this criminal, and you know, they're nearly lost to the criminal history of Victoria, and this is why sometimes we have to work against our assumptions.
An amazing story. I think that's an extraordinary segue to the next question. I'm fascinated myself in female sly groggers of the 20th century, and I guess there's a pretty grey area between what is sly grogging, who's being caught, and how they're caught. Are they just serving after hours? And then the 6 o'clock swill changes so much of that, or the 6 o'clock end of service. Women's roles in that time and breaking the law, or what's perceived to even be a law, has changed so much. But therein lies that creativity that's employed. And I was reading very recently about a hotel in Footscray where they had a room under the stairs for exactly the purpose of serving after hours. And well, in the 20th century, you know, in particular your books that you've worked on in this area of women being very predominant as licensees of hotels, what creativity have you come across?
Yeah, so let's just maybe get some of the history straight, because we're so used to being told that the pub is no place for a woman, and that pubs have been places of, you know, sort of sexual apartheid for women, stuck out in the ladies' lounge or sitting in the car out the front of the pub, being brought, brought a shandy by their husband, or just having to wait there until their husband came out. You know, there's so many stories that run through Australian folklore about the way that women have been excluded from pubs. But when you actually go back and you have a look at the records, which is what I did for my PhD thesis now, that was about 1,000 years ago, and that first book, Beyond the Ladies' Lounge, what I actually did find was that as publicans, as actually the people who were in control of the space, over 50% of Victoria's pubs by the turn of the 20th century were run by women. And there were all sorts of laws that meant that women actually had to, the publican had to receive the proceeds of the business. And you couldn't be a dummy publican, which means you couldn't just hold the license to the hotel. And so, you know, there are various ways of substantiating the fact that these women were actually in control of the business. And then there's also a lot of folklore that holds up that idea too. You know, you start to talk about women in pubs and everybody's got a story about Ma Ring, who ran this hotel, or, you know, my grandma this, or my auntie that. And, you know, people know that women were very invested in pub keeping, but putting those statistics around it was something else, to show that actually by the turn of the 20th century, hotel keeping, particularly in Victoria and New South Wales as well, really was a girls' club. So unlike the 19th century, where there was like a blanket law on the goldfields that you couldn't sell alcohol, pub licenses didn't start to be given out until 1854, and then there were very strict rules around who could get them in and what circumstances. There were a lot more rules in the 20th century, but that also meant there were a lot more rules that could be broken, which then put you in a kind of different category of criminality. I found no evidence to show that women were prosecuted any more than men were. So there's sort of no sense that there was a kind of latent sexism within the licensing industry that was kind of persecuting women as publicans. But there's plenty of evidence that women were breaking the law. There were, you know, ways of being able to have a cocky, they would call them, who was out in the back lane, who would let them know if a licensing inspector was coming along, and then, you know, quickly the lights would be turned off and things shut up again. There were ways of being able to, you know, continue to sell alcohol after hours. And but, you know, so many of these things were local. So many of these things were condoned by the local community, and condoned by the police. Again, these were protection rackets that were run, and women were part of this as well. There are the kind of famous pub criminals, you know, the Tilly Devines, and, you know, those type of ones. We interestingly much more associate them with New South Wales, with Sydney in particular, Sin City. Far fewer, and I can't think of one famous female publican criminal in Melbourne. Maybe we're just more staid society in general, or the cover-ups were better. But, you know, women did keep prostitutes in their upstairs rooms. But again, it wasn't a huge part of the industry. I mean, interestingly, one of the reasons that women could get licenses right from the very beginning of the licensing law was that it was considered that they would be more reputable, that they would be more moral, that they would have more ability to control the distribution of alcohol within the colony, and particularly because it was a male-dominated colony, a penal colony right from the very start, that women had essentially would have a stronger, tighter grip on the wheel than male publicans would. And it was very difficult for a male publican to get a license without being able to show he had a woman who was going to be helping him in the industry, whether that was his wife or his sister or a daughter. But having a woman as part of your business made it much more much easier for you to get a license if you were a bloke.
And therein, I think, is part of the one of the social misnomers, again, is that, well, because she's female, she wouldn't have X, Y, and Z. It kind of created a front where you get female criminals much earlier on, I admit, exactly like robbing a bank, but no one would assume that a woman would do so. Have you come across other examples of really taking advantage of one's gender in the positive for their own career?
Oh, that's an interesting one. Well, not in a criminal sense. I mean, I would say the way that women took advantage was to kind of hide behind this screen of respectability, so that the notion that women were going to be more moral, particularly when it came to running a hotel, that they were going to be more moral, that they would be able to control men's behavior. I mean, this is both true, like women, I interviewed women and who had grown up in hotels with mothers and grandmothers who were publicans and who were publicans themselves. And they did say that women made better publicans because men did look to women to have their behavior control, that men actually want to be told what to do. They want to be told when they've had enough. And that if a male publican said, "Hey, Frank, I think, you know, you're pretty full there, mate, probably best to get home," then that is being seen as some kind of confront or affront to his virility or his manhood, and, you know, could lead to blows, could lead to criminal behavior. But a woman says, "Hey, Frank, think it's time to get home to Doris, you know, we'll see you tomorrow, that's enough." He's actually looking for the brakes to be put on that behavior, and he says, "Yep, nah, you're right, Ma, it's time for me to go." And this is why female publicans were often called Ma or Mother, and that was a term of you know, of affection, but seen to this maternal kind of role that they could kind of look after their largely male clientele. Doesn't mean that all women in that role were maternal, that they had these, you know, many of them were just very, very canny businesswomen. They were very good at making money. They were very good at using the pub as a way to get into other parts of society that otherwise would have been cut off for them. Like, you know, have a look at the number of female councillors, particularly in the country these days, women who become the mayor or get on council. Look how many of them ran pubs. There's an incredible connection between those things. So it was a way of women getting status, and the publican was very high status in the 19th and early 20th century. They were on par with the bank keeper and the town doctor and the town notary and, you know, the lawyers. And this was it was a very elite social group that they joined, and that was a way of women being able to move up through the social sphere, but particularly to be able to move their children up. And this is what women knew, that they could marry their daughters off to the lawyers and the doctors, and that their sons could get a good private school education because of the profits of the pub, and they could get a foothold in property. And so, you know, women weren't necessarily going into hotel keeping in order to be the good God's police of society, which is the way that the legislation in very many ways wrote them in. They went in there to be good businesswomen, make coin, and move their get their, have their own sense of satisfaction and control over their finances and their daily lives, and to move their children up the chain. You scratch most families who have doctors, lawyers, and Indian chiefs, and who have been in this country for four or five generations, and you will find publicans in them. I remember sitting next to Tim Costello on a plane once going somewhere, you know, Tim, Reverend Tim Costello, brother of the former treasurer Peter Costello. And I was telling him about this work. I don't know how we got into it. And he said, oh, yeah, the Costellos were publicans. And I went back through the records and I found, yep, I found all those Costellos. He said, it's not something my brother likes to crow about. He said, but I'm not ashamed of it. So.
How funny.
So interesting that the Reverend doesn't mind revealing that his the start that many of these families got in life was from Pub Bunny, was from Grog.
Interesting. As we swing this the full circle back to where we started, what was the relationship between women and the law? I mean, that's kind of militaristic law, but on the goldfields in that second 6 months of 1854, what was the women's relationship to the law on the goldfields in that upheaval time?
So it's a really interesting relationship because what happens is that women come onto the goldfields and they come in great numbers. A third of the population of Ballarat was women and children, and at least a quarter of the population of the total goldfields was women and children. And again, we have this, you know, this idea that the goldfields was this male-only place. That was gender exclusive, and it's just not true. And the thing about the licensing system was that it was essentially a poll tax, that if you wanted to be there and you wanted to mine for gold, or you wanted to run a business to be a shopkeeper, you had to take out a license. And it was irrespective of, and the fee that you paid was irrespective of your income. And so it was essentially, it was a head tax, and women's heads were there, and women were mining, and they also were running shops. So they had to take out the license. And so they had this kind of legal identity at a time when otherwise married women were defined as a femme covert, covered by their husband. They had no legal identity of their own. And this prohibited women from going into business because you couldn't get a loan if you didn't have a legal identity. And by the by, it's one of the reasons that so many women went into pubs, because they couldn't get finance to run other businesses. But because pub licenses were so often attached to a brewery, the brewery would pay for the woman to take the license and go in there. These were called, it was called the Tied House system. There was a royal commission about it at the turn of the century. But it essentially provided a stream of finance to women that wasn't available to them otherwise. And so here were women on the goldfields. They had this legal identity that was vested in them as a license holder. And so this gave them a stake in not just the community relationships that were going around, but the commercial relationships and the legal one as well. And of course, one of the great grievances of the miners was that they had no voice in making the laws that pertained to them, because at this particular time, you could only vote if you were a property holder. And you couldn't own property in Victoria, and a license wasn't considered property until after the Eureka Stockade. But once it was, once the miners, including women, burned their licenses as a symbol of protest and gathered at the stockade to defend their rights and liberties, and women were involved in every aspect of that, then afterwards, when the miners' right came in, if you held a license, you could have access to land, and you also had access to a vote. And women took this up. So as early as the first elections in 1856, women were voting. And I have a wonderful doctoral student, Casey Sinclair, who lives in Castlemaine, a former goldfield, and she's researching the life of one of the women who was living on the goldfield at the time, a woman called Fanny Finch, who was running a restaurant, was almost definitely also a sly grogger, probably had a past life in prostitution, was now a single mother feeding her four children, was persecuted by the police in various ways. She was also interestingly Black, but not Indigenous. She was she had African British heritage, and she is the first named woman to vote in Australia in 1856. She cast a ballot in Castlemaine in those 1856 elections. And there were other women who did this as well. And this eventually, this loophole in the law was tightened up, so that by, I think it was the 1863 legislation, the term persons was specifically changed to male persons, instead of just being property holders, because owning this license did entitle people to a municipal vote. And if you were on the municipal roll, then you were entitled to be on the Victorian roll. And so through this, there's this extraordinary legal loophole that women saw, slipped themselves through, were quite open and public about, wrote to newspapers proclaiming their right to be and desire to be voters, and asking as well whether they could stand for election themselves. So, you know, if we just think about the history of suffrage, this is 50 years before before women got the vote federally. It's 30 years before women got the vote in South Australia, the first Australian colony to give women the vote. And 40 years before that, that's 1894 that happens. And so extraordinarily early, women were very, let's just say women were very literate about the law. They knew exactly what they could do and what they couldn't do. And when they saw an opportunity to use these loopholes, they took them.
Do we find this difference in goldfield or golden triangle women's roles between your Ballarat frontier and some of the slightly more, I'll say Bendigo and Castlemaine are two good examples. Is there a difference between women's roles in Ballarat versus some of their neighbouring towns in that time?
Certainly my research focused on Ballarat in a much more granular detail, but no, there's evidence that this was kind of across the board. Ballarat certainly had the highest numbers of women, so you know, you could argue that there's a kind of safety in numbers there, but no, these activities were going on. You know, you do see them everywhere. Women appearing in the court records, and as witnesses to crimes, as perpetrators of crimes, and let's also be really clear, as the victims of crime. So I don't want to romanticize crime. I think that's you know, something that we can easily fall into a trap of doing. Particularly when we're talking about it is in terms of survival. You know, crime's crime. And women were very often the victims of sexual crimes. Young girls were the victims of sexual crimes. And they were certainly the victims of domestic violence and abuse that could result in their murder, as it still is today. And there's just outstanding amounts of evidence of that. It's a very little researched area of Australian history. There are scholars who are just starting to look at the history of domestic violence as it's becoming more of a the issue is gaining more prevalence and more visibility in our contemporary life. There are people who are looking back to historical antecedents. And I've got another PhD student who is looking at this specifically about domestic violence on the goldfields. And it is rife. And brutal, and really brutal. And women being bludgeoned with hammers, with crowbars, and, you know, as well as fists, women's throats being cut, brutal rapes. You know when things are really crossed the pale, because a reporter in a of a court case will say the details are too horrific for us to publish. These rapes, again, I was talking about the euphemisms before, rapes are usually called outrages. Mm. So if you find reporting of an outrage, it's generally a rape. And you know, unfortunately, it's so often where the researchers of women's history or looking for women in history, I don't like the term women's history because it makes it sound like it's only about women or for women or would only be of interest to women. But we're actually just talking about history, but the things that have happened to women, or about women or by women, it's all of our histories. We should all know it. It's relevant to all of us. But we so often find women in the records in court cases as either witnesses or as victims. That's where we hear women's voices most strongly.
I think the converse nature of crime becomes very apparent when people do very quickly glamorize or glorify a specific thing. And one of my interests topics is that 20th century sly grog trade, particularly Fitzroy. There was a tremendous group of coppers who brought that down. And they, you know, to show that other half of that discussion is equally as exciting as the, you know, the really pretty wretched people that were pursuing it in the first place. But the Terrible Ten is possibly one of the most undercovered Australian histories that we've ever had. I've been fascinated.
Let's remember why sly grogging. Also, you know, why the authorities wanted to regulate alcohol consumption in the first place. And these two strands of what we're saying aren't disconnected. I mean, you know, one of the reasons why alcohol has been controlled and that many reformers have wanted it to be prohibited altogether is because of the effects of drunkenness on women. Domestic violence and alcohol consumption go together. It's not that only drunks, and particularly only poor drunks, were bashing up their wives. I'm not taking a class argument here at all, but there's, you know, absolutely a connection between violence and alcohol consumption. And so, you know, in shutting down illegal alcohol trade, I mean, part of that was about protecting the government's revenue stream, because once you license something, the government is taking money from it. So part of it's that, and part of it is about regulating social behavior. So you can say on one level that sly grogging is a victimless crime. On another level, it's not, because people who have a skin full were more likely to abuse and hurt other people.
You have the greatest collection of slang I've ever come across. They had a skin fly. I haven't heard that in years and years. It's a great expression, though. My last question is, I've been reading a fair bit about who made exactly what when it comes to sly grog. And it tended to be that there was more, it was easier to make ale than anything else, because it's the same wheat and yeast as bread. You'll get more calories from drinking the ale than you'll expend and then get out of the bread. Did you find that you've ever come across evidence of particular kinds of alcohol being used in areas? So for example,
so interesting. I haven't looked into that. I mean, certainly in those early years of the gold rush in colonial Australia in general, but also in the gold rush, beer was a really unstable product. It could kill people. You know, they hadn't gotten refrigeration right. If you didn't get the balances of all of those, the particular cocktail of yeast and brewing and everything, it was dangerous. On the other hand, it was also safer than a lot of the water could be. Alcohol was safer than water. So, there's a long history of that going back through Britain. The kids drank beer and other forms of alcohol because it was a safer beverage than drinking the water. but it wasn't the beverage of choice for a long time. Rum certainly was, whiskey, hard liquor was more likely to be sold in sly grog tents. And to my knowledge, that wasn't made by the sly groggers themselves, moonshining or running a still, or you know, that kind of thing. I've never really come across evidence of that. My understanding was that the alcohol was, you know, the people who were making great money during the gold rush was the merchants, the wine and spirit merchants, and that's what they were called, wine and spirit merchants. They didn't become beer, wine and spirit merchants until much later in the 19th century.
Very good observation. Dr. Claire Wright, thank you so much again for joining me. It has actually been a personal thrill, as well as one for everybody listening, I'm sure. If you are listening to this on any number of platforms, do make sure you hit the follow button. It helps me to reach other people who desperately need this in their lives. Otherwise, head over to Facebook, check out Rory Malloy, and then you've got to write the word author. And this is dedicated to the Dawn of Crime book series, which you can find by Googling The Dawn of Crime.